Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello and welcome to another Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch. And somebody very kind, while they were on the way shopping, dropped up some flapjacks. So we are actually eating cake together in a small way.
One cake, two locations. That's better than no cake.
Right, now we're working on omens, aren't we? And I know what I wanted to talk about today, so I thought, well, I'll see if anything comes in to make that right, you know, a follow-on sign. Mm-hmm. And I turned on the radio having thought about it, and it was just in that moment on Bridge Over Troubled Water, where there's the little intercession bit before they go to the last verse, and there's that sort of, it's almost like an egg whisk thing that they hit on the on the cymbals, it's shush, 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 and I love that. And then Art Garfunkel goes into Sail On Silver Girl, Sail On By, which has always been my go-to moment of it's going to be okay, it's fine. And I used to listen to that when I was really, really broke, and I mean really broke. Mm. And what I wanted to talk about was money, so I think that would be a follow-on sign, wouldn't you?
If it's got an association with brokenness in your mind, then yes, absolutely, definitely.
Yes, it has. And then, of course, I missed the turning, so I thought, maybe not. Because I had to pop out to the shops before we came and sat down here. So, so there I am in the car thinking, oh, I'll just go down to the shops, pick up something, turn on the radio, miss the bloody shops. I've lived here 8 years.
I mean, the missing the turning could be part of the omen. I guess, is missing the turning part of the story of money that you wanted to talk about in any way?
Well, the reason I wanted to talk about it is because spiritual people don't talk about money. They talk about prosperity, but not money. Mm-hmm. I've actually had workshops where I've said, I want to talk about money. And they went, no. And I said, I want to talk about prosperity. And they all relaxed and said, that's different. And I went, well, yeah, but if you've got the issue around money, it isn't. Mm-hmm. It's still a big issue. And I thought the last time we talked, I probably sounded really white privileged about money because I was doing a bad habit I've got, which was a quick summation instead of a day's workshop.
Right.
So I was thinking, I've got to put that better. And I thought, I bet we are on slightly different pages, so can we talk about it?
Let's talk about it.
Okay, because I can actually talk about it as a Christian.
Okay.
I know that's pretty shocking, isn't it?
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Aren't the moneylenders meant to be the bad people in the temple? I'm shit-stirring, I might add.
Moneylenders who lend at profit are not popular.
Right.
No, turning the tables over in the temple is about corrupting the home spirit, you know, because you had to buy a temple tithe to go into the temple. You had to get your token. And, of course, the moneylenders would charge you whatever they thought they could get away with.
Wow, but seriously, you had to buy something to be able to go into the temple?
Well, you had to bring an offering, yes.
Wow. But the offering specifically was of money.
Well, I don't know what the actual tithe was. That's a very good point. I think it was a token. But I think if you weren't known, you had to show a gesture of good faith. Now, this is actually immediately an interesting one about how they operated out there, because we tend to think you had to pay to go into the temple. You actually had to pay to go into nearly all our temples nowadays, our big churches, our cathedrals, you have to pay to go into, unless you're praying. Mm-hmm. So that isn't actually any different. I'm not saying that it's right. But in those days, let's start with the 30 pieces of silver and Judas. Because Judas, who betrayed Jesus, without whom there'd be no Christianity, and some people might think that's a good thing, but the whole point of mystical Christianity is teaching you how to deal with betrayal. Mm-hmm. So without the betrayal, there's nothing. There's no story. But Judas was given 30 pieces of silver for telling the officials where to find Jesus. Mm-hmm. And you note that Jesus waited there instead of going away. So I think that was a delusion. I think absolutely a setup. But in those days, if you gave information, you were expected to receive a reward, 30 pieces of silver, and it was regarded by the mindset of that time. So we can judge it, but that's how it was, that if you wouldn't accept the money, your information was false because you weren't committing to that money, that information being true.
And was 30 pieces of silver a lot or a little?
It was the correct amount for information. For arresting a felon. But we don't get taught that. It's all, he took money. And, of course, the whole Christian thing has become that money is bad, except when you donate it to the church or to the Vatican or something like that. And that is completely contrary to the Old Testament and completely contrary to what Jesus is teaching. He's always saying, yes, things like don't place your treasure on earth, place it in heaven. But he's also saying, take no worry for tomorrow. Consider the lilies of the field. And what he's trying to teach is a mindset of enough, that I have enough, that God will always give me enough. And if I haven't got enough, somebody's taught me the wrong mindset.
Okay.
And that's going to push some buttons. So let's...
Well, yeah. It's interesting, actually, yeah. because I say reasonably similar things in that, to me, enough is a word now that's so misinterpretable.
Yeah.
That I actually prefer sufficient.
Yeah, because, go for it.
Simply because, for some reason or other, maybe because I first heard Satish Kumar use it, I don't know. But sufficient for me is the enough of enough when you don't need, I don't know, not great sort of, not gold-plated taps, but you know, when there's a roof over your head and food in your belly and you trust that, you know, without actual acts of God, in inverted commas, those things will still be present tomorrow.
Yes.
But you're not necessarily, you know, so kind of affluent that you are completely certain that come what may, they will be there in another one or two decades. And there's so sufficient for me, and this might be an entirely personal piece of semantics, I don't know, has in it the idea that actually the future, you have completely laid the future at the hands of the spirits, at the hands of the divine, of the goddess, of the gods, that you trust that today I have enough, and tomorrow I don't know about, but I'm trusting that there'll be enough.
Yeah, tomorrow will take care of itself. Exactly. Yes.
Whereas in the word enough, enough along with prosperity, bloody consciousness, has been used so much that enough seems to mean, well, I've got enough when I can guarantee myself that I can, you know, anything and everything could happen and I'm going to be all right, Jack, from now till kingdom come kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that's more than enough. Because there's no requirement for trust in that. And so but the other thing that I wanted to say is that in these conversations, as soon as we start talking about that stuff, literally the whole of me just goes into kind of a prickle mode of, it's all very well for us to say we are totally sitting here in white privilege. Absolutely, 100% sitting here in white privilege, because we have enough today, we had enough yesterday, and there's every chance we'll have enough tomorrow. And that for the people who do not have enough, whatever their circumstances, to sit there and go, oh, just trust the gods, makes some spit nails.
Yeah,
and,
which is why we have to talk about it, I think.
Right.
Exactly, that.
Tell me more.
And I completely get about the language. It's like people are always telling me to be grateful, your gratitude. I don't use that word because to me that means being grateful to my grandma for the presents I didn't want and having to write thank you letters. So my semantics are, I don't use gratitude, I use appreciation. So it's incredibly important for us to talk about the linguistics, the semantics, the language, all that. And this is the topic, apart from death, that we humans don't understand and won't work with. And if I can give you a little bit of my story, yes, I'm a white, middle-class, privileged woman. I was born into a middle-class family where my father owned his own building company. My mother didn't have to work. Mm-hmm. My mother had mental health issues, so there was a lack of prosperity there. And my father gave up his company and spent the rest of his life chasing steam engines and writing books. And I'm his daughter. I spent the rest of my life chasing spirituality and writing books. So I can see that there's blood in there. Mm. But I was raised to believe that there would be the enough on your definition. And there wasn't. Mm. Everything in my life fell apart financially. And that's part of my karma and my lesson, and one of the reasons why I can teach at least people in this country, in America and things like that, though we must talk about what this means for people in countries like India at the moment, what's going on in India at the moment. Mm-hmm. But I ended up having been a TV producer and presenter with a broken marriage, lost my home, £50,000 in debt, stuck in Montana, trying to bring a dog home in a way that was possibly legal, completely falling apart with nothing, ending up peeling potatoes in a pub in order to try and make the rent when I got back to London. So I do know what it's like not to have that enough. Mm. I have worked minimum wage, and I have sat in a pub kitchen at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning and wept. Mm-hmm. And been terrified. I have, before it was easy to bank online, I've walked 2 miles from my home to the bank to take £5 out of one account to put it into another account. Mm. And, you know, that's the minimum you can take out with a cash machine. So, yeah. You know, I do have some understanding, and I have lived and travelled in China where there is poverty on the huge thing. And yet, you know, I will say this, the people who've been born in poverty are much wiser than we are in so many ways. I mean, rural people in places like China, I'm not necessarily talking about townships, those are another thing. And we also do have to sort of talk about the aspect of tribal karma. Countries have karmas. Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure that the United Kingdom is extremely responsible for a lot of the karma that's going on in England at the moment, and we will have to pay that. Mm. And God, but you know, what I've learned, because I had to learn it, because I was on the edge of this really white middle-class family who didn't really want to help this rebel who'd done everything wrong, you know, and was worshipping this weird God that they didn't believe in, all that kind of thing. They've always been kind to me, but it's always been, do you want to come for Christmas? Okay, we won't have to do presents, that sort of thing. And then they've all given me presents, which made me feel...
Oh, hideous.
Yeah, yeah, really, all that kind of stuff. So obviously I can't speak for somebody who was born in poverty, but I achieved poverty and I've had poverty thrust upon me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the richest person in the world now. I don't own a house. I don't know how I'll pay the rent in 2 months' time. I don't. Mm. I simply don't. But I will, because I'll trust. And what I have learnt in Christianity is how to go right down deep into what does a prosperity consciousness actually mean. And the bad news for a lot of people is it doesn't mean having enough to have your nails done and your face lifted and all the designer clothes. It really doesn't. And Jesus would never teach that. Mm. And if you're wealthy enough to have that, enjoy it. Fabulous. Go for it. Very happy for you. Not what I want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if your whole life is predicated around being able to have Netflix, Amazon Prime, your nails done, your hair done, you are above and beyond 95% of the rest of the world.
Yeah, totally.
And I actually, when I was in geography in sixth form, doing what was back there A-levels, I actually got a commendation from the teacher for defining modern society. And I just said, when a luxury is regarded as a necessity.
Oh, yes. Yes, 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 yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So there you're really into the whole thing of what my problem with the word enough is when luxury is defined as necessity.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've never been in Montana stuck with absolutely nothing. Mm. But
But, you know, I raised my children on working in cafes and trying to run my own business and child benefit and and whatever the other thing's called.
Working tax credit saved me.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. God, I completely lost my thread. Oh, yeah. And I remember at one point, I mean, there are two things that really stick out in my mind about that, the whole scenario where that is concerned. And the first is that I have always felt, rich, not in an ostentatious way, and clearly not in a have you got any money way. But I do own my own house. Not necessarily because I come from that kind of background, but because one of the things in my background, which was our endless travelling. My father had such wanderlust. We were to be found somewhere in a camper van in Europe at, you know, most times in my childhood. And it gave me this insane determination that I would own my own home and that I would buy one and that no bastard was ever going to make me move once I'd got it.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, I, you know, arrived on the scene of work as a in the 80s and got very lucky indeed when the house prices crashed horribly in the 80s. Luckily.
No, you had a prosperity consciousness. It's not luck.
Okay, well, yeah, the gods were incredibly kind to me, and so I sold one place at the very, very high and bought the next at the very, very low.
Yeah.
And as a result of that and some other things, I am lucky enough to have a house in partnership with a mortgage company, obviously. But slightly derailed myself then.
Do you know what mortgage means?
No, what does it mean?
Grip of death.
Grip of death.
Mortgage.
I am in the grip of death.
Sorry.
Oh my God. Both. So here we go. Both of them all at once. What was I trying to say?
Sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, yeah. So no, that I've always felt rich because I utterly love my life and where I live and my husband and my children and my dogs and, you know, blah, blah, blah. To me, that's what makes me rich, is that I'm so full of love and, you know, touch wood, terrible things haven't really happened. Lots of very confronting things have happened to me, and they might seem terrible in the moment, but I feel very lucky, and therefore I feel very rich. And I found out, due to the, you know how condescending young people can be, said with the most loving, vast bucket of condescension, one of my kids pointed out to me that I was talking about how rich we were and of course we should give, I can't remember what to, I can't remember who. And he said, Mum, you do realise that the two of you live well below minimum wage and that what you're doing, if you just went and stacked shelves in a co-op, you'd be so much better off. Mm-hmm. And that was insane to me. I couldn't believe it. And then the other thing was, when we found out not long after that, what it is that people are supposed to expect to consider themselves not below the poverty line. And it included all these things like, I don't know, hairdressers and dinners out and takeaways and things which we hadn't participated in at all for 25 years or something, because there's no possibility whatsoever that we could have afforded them.
Mm.
And that bizarre level of expectation that in order to not be poor, you should have the capacity to go and sit in a restaurant. I feel, if I'm really honest, but maybe I'm just a hideous Puritan at heart, I just feel that that's a bit weird. But then I'm hearing myself say that and just thinking, well, maybe you are just a bizarre Puritan and why shouldn't people be able to allowed to go and eat out? But yeah, I don't know. Tell me about it.
No, exactly. You see, it is such a huge topic. Can you see how huge it is? And how it gets at our guts?
Yeah.
Because for us in this modern world, money means survival.
Yeah.
And so anything we talk about, taking anything away from somebody, including painted fingernails, that kind of thing, it feels like a threat. It actually does. Because our we've talked about this before, how our connection to the earth now is so poor and our connection to our gut feelings is so poor that we're actually trained into thinking that we need to survive things that we don't.
Yeah.
And I'm gathering wild garlic at the moment and I'm really, really pissed off because our Raeburn's broken and the Raeburn mending man has not come for more than a month and I want to be dehydrating my wild garlic and I can't. So that in me is a poverty consciousness. But for most people, you know, I can't do my wild garlic. I want to dehydrate, but oh God, I'm going to have to ferment my wild garlic. Well, what a problem is that? It's not a problem at all, really. But we are trained into what you have to have. And it's been interesting over the pandemic watching how people have responded. I got really intimidated by everybody who learned to make sourdough because I'm crap at it. I didn't try. And all the what are you watching and what are you doing? And the let's go couch to 5K. Because some people were trying to achieve things and some people were lost in the distract me away from. And it just shows where we are. Some of us just want to be entertain me. I don't want to face this. I don't want to look at this. I want to be away from this. Just. And the irony is, when you're watching TV, you're watching other people earn money. Really, you are. And and that's kind of okay. I'm rambling a lot because this isn't a workshop. But the thing that really pointed a big pivot around prosperity in the spiritual community for me was when I did start teaching prosperity because I most needed to learn it, was the resentment against those who do have money.
Yeah.
The huge anger and resentment. And then I would say, well, do you want it? No, I don't want it. And though that's a crossed wire spiritually. Mm-hmm. You may not have the money. I do not want the money. That's actually sending out a message that says, I do not want money.
Yeah.
And the universe can't give it you. Yeah. As soon as you hate the other who's got the money, your whole psyche is going to say, well, I don't want to hate me anymore, so I won't be having any money.
That's really interesting because to me, one of the barriers to prosperity that I potentially could name is that I have seen over the years, including in myself, so many people for whom the story is, money is evil, and therefore if I have money, that we've been, you know, we've had that, I guess that's a thing from Christianity,
is it? Yes, it is. Yeah. It's a misinterpretation, but yes.
That money's evil and therefore I mustn't have any because I don't want to be evil.
Yes.
And I remember realising that there was a really strong thread in me, even though it's like, I'd love to win the lottery because I do this and I do this and, you know, all that. And I realised that you do actually need to buy a ticket to win the lottery, but it didn't stop me having those thoughts. But then I realised, oh, do you know what? I wouldn't want to win the lottery because the overwhelming sense of responsibility I would have about what the hell I would do with this money would completely destroy the pleasure.
Yes.
And if I did, you know, one of the things that I'd love to win the lottery because I'd love to rethatch what used to be a thatched cottage and isn't anymore. Yeah. You know, that's a complete fantasy of mine. Wouldn't it be glorious to rethatch this cottage? But I'd feel so guilty that I'd spent that money on something so frivolous when I could have, you know, potentially bailed a friend or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I'm quite certain I will never win the lottery. As a result.
If you don't buy a ticket.
No.
Yes, again, there's so much in there. There's a whole workshop just in what you said.
Yeah.
And I do find this fascinating, and I'm sorry if everybody hates the fact that I find it fascinating, but having lived through it, the thing is I have worked with myself to think, what would I do with money? Because unless the ability to be that prosperous is in my consciousness, I never will. And I do follow the system of tithing as I understand it as a mystic, which I've talked about before, so clear, which is connection, take care of yourself, then take care of everybody else. Mm. But yes, we have got this whole thing about money is evil, but it's only evil if you do bad things with it. It's completely neutral.
Otherwise, it's just an energy. Exactly. Yes. That's what I have subsequently learned, that it's completely neutral and it's an energy.
Yeah. And why?
And it's a method of exchange.
Yes. It's a human-created method of exchange, which we created because we stopped trusting each other.
Yeah. Well, and because life became more complicated than I put up your fence, you give me the eggs.
It did, yes, that's right. So let me give you a token, which means that somebody else, if I give you the token, you give the token to somebody else who can mend your fence, whereas you... Yes, exactly. No, it was a good idea creating money. But then we started focusing on it rather than the value in us.
The exchange.
And the exchange and the wish to benefit. And I now know exactly what I would do with £1 million, £5 million, £10 million, £20 million, £100 million. I know. what I would do.
Wow.
I know where I would tithe the first 10%, because I would, mm-hmm. to teachers and people that who have inspired me. Mm-hmm. Then I would buy us a lovely home.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would buy a house in Lucca where all my friends could go and stay whenever they wanted to, fully serviced. Then I would rent a Caribbean island where we could all go for a summer, and everybody I know could have a first-class plane ticket so they could have that.
Oh my God.
And then I would buy homes for everybody I know who needs one, and I would donate where I felt ready. But I would take care of us, and then from that, take care of others. So probably I'm more likely to win the lottery than you are.
Maybe, although...
Must remember to buy a ticket.
Yeah, must remember to buy a ticket. I'm so sorry to be, like, really judgmental. And
no, please do. I want you to be.
But I am quite shocked by your, I'm going to buy a Caribbean island and send lots of people on planes there. Just because you are so not looking after the planet or our future.
Yeah.
Or any of that with that wish.
Yes, I get that. And you are right. But I'm also creating joy.
Yeah. No. I don't know. I mean, if you offered me a plane ticket to go to your Caribbean island, you'd be creating appalled in me.
Fine,
joy,
then don't go.
No, but I won't.
A lot of people I know aren't at the level of understanding about the planet, and perhaps I could offset the. But isn't that interesting?
Mm.
What's really interesting is that we've already got a scenario where one of us can look at the other and say that's wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm not upset about that. You are absolutely right. It would not be a good thing to do. And I'm talking to you about how I've worked over 30 years about this. And I think you're right. I've got to rework that one.
Okay. Hurrah!
However, if there's any other way that I can offer a wonderful holiday to people, I probably would.
Mm.
I'm not going to buy the island. I just rent it. And maybe they could go on a ship. No, that's bad, isn't it? Oh, God. All right, I'll rethink that.
Cornwall's nice. Well, so's Devon, for that matter.
Do we want any more tourists this year? But this is great, because I want you to challenge me on this, because I taught prosperity. I stopped teaching it about 15, 20 years ago, and I'm a different person now. So you challenging me on it will make me rework my things as well.
Mm.
But I would not. I would be afraid to have a lot of money, but I'd accept that responsibility as God-given.
Mm.
And I would try to do my best with it.
So when you've inherited your, or whatever it is, your what have you
don't
done?
Don't think won I'm the, inheriting no, anything
okay.
this time.
Okay. When you've won the lottery and you've got your 5 million quid, can I invite you to consider one question before you consider all others? And that is encapsulated by the notion of what's being increasingly called the children's spire, which is originally a Native American teaching, which is that all decisions must take into account and into the heart of everything that's kind of opted for is how will this decision, this choice that we make in this moment, affect all of the children, so the children of all beings, not just human beings, but the trees and the salmon and the, all the rest of them, or the wild garlic, for 7 generations.
Mm-hmm.
So for 200 years, how will what I am choosing to do now affect the world that I will leave behind me when I die?
And just think that if I did win, was it 500 million, did you say?
Whatever. Yeah, go on then, 500 million, why not?
How much good could be done?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's actually what I'm trying to say. I'm an ordinary human being who makes mistakes and says stupid things and makes bad decisions a lot of the time and some good decisions.
Yeah.
I am willing to face that challenge, because I would hope... there's no doubt about it, if you're wealthy, you will be accruing karma if you do not do good things with that money.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons why people are afraid of it, for sure. Mm. It is a really, really big thing, but I am willing to face that. And I would take advice.
Cool. Get on then, universe. 5 million for Maggie, or what was it? 500 million?
And I'd say, would you like your roof thatched?
Yes. It's the ecological choice in many ways. Well, genuinely.
But it's interesting that people say, no, I don't want the money. And I'm saying, but couldn't you do good with it?
Yeah.
And one of the exercises I would get to people is say, I want you to understand that it is purely energy. And whether or not you're going to have what you need and what you want, you've got to change your attitude around that energy. Because if you're sitting there going, oh, I hate those rich bastards in Parliament, and who do they think they are and all that, you are pushing it from you. And if you're saying, well, that's okay, I'm pushing it from me and you're happy, that's great. But the most people who are broke aren't happy. Most people who are rich aren't happy. And which
may mean that happiness and money are unrelated.
It is true.
Yeah.
I truly believe that happiness and money are not unrelated.
Yeah, me too.
You do not feel you do not feel any better crying into a silk damask cushion than you do feel crying into a straw-filled cushion or no cushion at all. You still feel like rubbish. So no, all the possessions in the world won't make anything better.
Okay, so for the person who is the very opposite of, you know, here's you and me sitting, we're white, we're middle class, we're of a certain age.
We're on Zoom. We've got laptops.
Exactly. We've got roofs over our head. We've got laptops. We've got all that stuff. If I'm... You're from Birmingham. If I'm in Birmingham and I'm young and I'm a person of colour, perhaps, and I'm a woman and... maybe I am just setting out in life, but I just simply don't have any of the advantages that you and I have. What do I do? How can prosperity consciousness help me? What can it do for me?
Do you the easy answer for the modern world is, do you have an internet, access to an internet?
No, I don't.
In any way, shape or form? Not even
I can go to the library.
You can go to the library, okay. Well, then you have got access to the internet. What you can start to do is get onto YouTube and start looking at some of the videos from people who know how to teach about prosperity. Because that will probably piss you off to the nth degree and show you where the internal blocks that you have had trained into you are. One of the guys I knew when I was young in Dudley, I lived and worked in Dudley, which is the Black Country. And it's not a very prosperous place, really, Dudley. I mean, the joke we had was we were all trying to dig a tunnel to get out of Dudley. Yeah, and it was full of a lot of disadvantaged and coloured people, one of whom was called Lenny Henry. And I knew him because he used to sit in the foyer of the little newspaper I worked for. And we thought he was a sweet guy. He came from a poor family down the tracks, and his mother was a fearsome, absolute, wonderful, fearsome mama. And he was sitting there, and he was saying, I don't know, I just know I've got to do this.
Got to do what? What was he doing?
He wanted to make a career for himself in comedy, a little black guy from Dudley. And we gave him a little bit of publicity and backed him, and he won New Faces, and he went on to become Sir Lenny Henry.
Is he a sir?
As Othello. So it's possible for anyone, but you need the role models. And when you haven't got the role models, I'm actually going to posit that you do need God. Some kind of faith. And the difficulty with that is how corrupted Christianity has become about faith. But if you can get to a library and you can actually read the words that that guy, Jesus of Nazareth, allegedly said, they are the ticket.
So what did he say that is the ticket?
He said, consider the lilies of the field. They do not reap, neither do they sow. But I tell you, Solomon in all his glory was not attired by one of those. And not a sparrow falls. And take no care for tomorrow. And it's all stuff that you might think, ah, daddy, that's just wanky bollocks, but sit with it. Sit with the lilies of the field. And I did that when I was in Montana, trying to sell a cafe that was losing money hand over fist. I had no retail experience. I did not know what to do. My husband was back in England. He was going to divorce me. He wanted me to rehome the dog, come straight back. I knew that the marriage was failing. And I was stuck there. I had no income. I had a business that was failing. I had to try and pay the girls. I wasn't paying me. I never paid me a penny. I got to get the dog home. I got to do this. And I went to the minister, Philip Zemke, of Unity Church in Bozeman. And I just sat and said, Philip, I'm beaten. I don't want to leave without my dog. This is my dog. You know, and even now, nearly 20 years on. You know, and he said, honey, get out of God's way. You're standing right in the way of the Lord with all your fear. And I know it's hard. I know it's hard, but I want you to make a list of the things that you need right now. And I want you to come to church on Sunday, and I'm going to get you to stand up and ask. And then I want you to go and ride quarter horses in the sunset every single night until this is sorted.
Wow.
How many nights did you ride quarter horses for?
Most nights. Because I went home and I thought, well, can I trust this much? Can I? And then I thought, I have no alternative.
Yeah.
And that's the point. You sometimes just have to get so low, there's nowhere you can go but God. I did know that after Henry died, because there was one night I went so low in the bath with gin. And I went right down. I thought, let's see how low you can go. Because I had no... And I went right down. And at the bottom, there was a little spangly light.
Mm.
And it just grew. And I remember lying there in the bath and experiencing that there was something in the depths of this despair. There was something. So I went to Unity Church that Sunday and I stood up and I literally did say, I need somebody with a quarter horse so I can go riding. I need a manager for a cafe that I don't know how to run and I've got no money to pay them. I need a new home because I'm being evicted this weekend. It's got to be a home where I can go with a dog. I need somebody who speaks Spanish who can translate all the literature. Or French, I don't know which yet. I need somebody who knows somebody in France or Spain where I can take my dog for 6 months. And I'm going to need somebody to drive me to Seattle to take my dog to the airport. I need all these things. Can any of you help? 5 hands went up. The first one was somebody with a friend who had quarter horses who needed them to be exercised. The second was a guy called Charles Carell, who's still a friend, who was on disability benefit. He was a former restaurant manager.
Oh, my God.
The third hand was a Spanish lady called Carmen, who said, I will translate all your documents. And the fourth hand was somebody who said, I know John McElhattan, the vet. He will help you with all the stuff you need. And what's more, he's holistic, so he's going to help you through it. And the final one was, I have a house for rent.
Oh.
You know, and it's quite easy for people to say, well, that's all right for you, you're lucky, or something like that. But have you asked?
Yeah.
You know, and it worked out fine. That cafe sold the morning I left. And it didn't sell. I mean, we lost vast amounts of money on that cafe, but it sold.
Yeah, but money's only money, isn't
it?
And here you still are.
And here I still are. And I'm the first person in the world to bring a dog in legally from America to the UK on passports for pets. Nobody cares about that except me and the dog.
Yeah.
But we did it. We got all the help we wanted because I just gave it up, let go and let God. At the very worst, before I went to see Philip Zemke, I was actually back in the UK at that point. We'd had the visa turned down and I just didn't know what to do. I didn't have a visa. I couldn't get back to America. The dog was there. The cafe was there. But my husband and I were in England because we had to be there while they were trying to reassess the visa. So I'm just stuck. And it was my birthday.
Mm.
And I took the train to Birmingham to go and see my mother. I took the bus because they still had buses then. And as I got off the bus, there was a piece of litter on the ground. I leant down, picked it up and it said, let go and let God. And I thought, I got to listen.
Yeah.
And I got back to Montana for doing that because I had a phone call from a friend because it was my birthday. And he had worked for Central Television. He was a commissioning editor. He was now freelance. And he said, Maggie, I gather you're back in the UK. Come and have lunch with me. When can you come and have lunch? And he was in Birmingham, of course, because it was Central Television. I said, I can come tomorrow. So I went and had lunch with him. And I told him the whole story. And I said, I don't know what to do. I can't get back. The dog's there. The manager of the cafe has resigned. My husband doesn't want any more to do with it. You know, this is the biggest crisis. And he just said, Maggie, we've worked together in TV. I'm a commissioning editor. Write me a proposal for a documentary in Montana and I'll have you a visa within a week.
So you can, again, you can say, well, okay for you, you've been a television documentary, but this was all grace, you know, this was all synchronicity. So I wrote him that thing, and the US embassy phoned him, said, I want to speak to Richard Creasy, please. Why are you trying to get a visa for a woman who's had a visa turned down? And he said, because she's the only person in the world who can make this documentary. My name is Richard Creasy. I am responsible for this documentary, that and the other. And they went, okay, and they issued the visa.
Wow, good for him.
And I went into huge debt getting a plane back. I didn't know about the environment then. I couldn't really take a ship. It was rescuing my dog. Yeah. And then I went to see Philip. So my life is a life of miracles, but I've had to have the disasters for the miracles. And we're on 40 minutes.
No way, are we really?
Yeah.
We'll have to continue this next week. Okay.
Is that okay? Absolutely. Is this interesting?
It's fascinating. And yeah, my mind is a whirl and a goggle. And just like, there are so many details I want to know.
Of course.
Just because I'm nosy. But also that whole thing of the trust, my miracles are on a slightly less kind of white knuckle ride scale. But yeah, as soon as I went to the place of, okay, I'm totally just going to trust. In my language, it's I'm going to trust the spirits.
Yeah.
I'm going to trust the spirits. And I have been fine since I started doing that.
Yeah. Give up.
Yeah.
It's about giving up.
Yeah.
And you
specifically
give it
for me,
yes.
It was about letting go of the fear of, but I won't be okay, or I can't trust that I'll definitely be okay if I don't, you know. For example, what I'm thinking of is that I worked in a cafe for ages while I was still doing this work because the cafe would pay me every week, come what may, even though it was a paltry amount, frankly. But it was there. It was the one thing that was guaranteed.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, any numbers of clients for shamanic healing or for workshops or whatever, they were not guaranteed. And then the day I gave it up, it was like a tidal wave of work for me.
I've seen this so many times with clients. Mm. Once there's the courage to give up, then you can come. Because it's like this thing about clearing out clutter. You can have anything if you've got the space for it.
Yeah.
The universe will bow down at your feet if you've got the space. But we spend all our time cluttering ourselves up so we don't have the space, so we don't have the responsibility.
Oh, okay, more of this next week.
Lovely. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.